This podcast is brought to you by St. Joseph's Episcopal Church in Boynton Beach, Florida, in the United States of America. You can find us at stjoesweb.org. Come visit us when you are in town.
May the prayer of the psalmist today be ours as well. May the words on our lips and the meditations of our hearts be always acceptable in your sight, for you are our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. Good morning. Well, I'm happy to report that we left with 30 pilgrims to the Holy Land, and yesterday we brought 30 back. And amazingly, even with the incredible long journey home and losing an hour last night, could I have a show of hands of how many pilgrims are here this morning from our Holy... Look at that. So we're going to have every Episcopalian go on a pilgrimage because it seems to increase the average worship attendance at our church. Do any of you have an anger management problem? Nobody? Is that Wes? Thank you for your honesty, Wes. The rest of you, we are going to have a reality therapy course, and I'm expecting you all to sign up for it, because we all have anger management issues. There is not a single human being who doesn't have to manage their anger, because we all have it. And anger itself is not good nor bad. It is, as we say, pre-moral. It's a feeling. It's an emotion. It just happens, and we have it. The question for us becomes, what do I do with it? And that's what this gospel calls us to concentrate upon. Now, I did some studies on this, some research some years ago. Do you know, for the average American male, how many times they get angry during the average week? Any idea? Just shout out a number. 30? Who said 6? Somebody said 6? Because you nailed it. 6 times the average American male gets angry during a normal week. Do you know how many times the average American female gets mad or angry during the average week? 3. But I would say, but it lasts a lot longer. That's my editorial. No research to prove that. We all deal with anger. The question is what we do with it. And to really get in touch with how we handle anger, and especially as it relates to this gospel story, I want to talk a bit about the location of this gospel story, where our pilgrims just were 4 or 5 days ago. You see them in this photo standing in front of the Western Wall, the Wailing Wall as it is called, the only wall that remains from the great temple built by Herod the Great, destroyed in 70 AD. But back in the day, when Solomon's temple was created, it was to house the Ark of the Covenant. It was to house those tablets that were received on the mountaintop that had the Ten Commandments that we just heard about in our first reading today. It was a sign of God's covenant with them. It was the most incredibly sacred, holy thing they had. And that's where it lived. This is also the same spot that was Mount Moriah's location prior to Herod leveling out that plain to build up the place so he could build a temple on a flat surface. Mount Moriah is the place where Abraham went with his son Isaac because he heard the voice of God telling him to sacrifice his son Isaac. Remember that story in the Old Testament? And right before he kills his son, the angel comes and says, don't do it. And then they find a ram and they sacrifice the animal in its place. Another incredibly sacred historical spot, the same spot. If we were to go from this western wall and go to the right, you'll come to the corner of where the temple was. If we go to the next slide. This was the pinnacle of the temple. Now, I had not been on pilgrimage to Jerusalem since 1981, but in the intervening years, they have found the pinnacle of the temple. You all know the pinnacle of the temple. Remember, the devil took Jesus to the very pinnacle of the temple and said, if you will bow down and worship me, I will give you all this. Same location. This was the place where they would blow the trumpet, the shofar, to announce the Sabbath, the Shabbat, as they say. And we know that this was the place because they've discovered the stone when the temple was destroyed in 70 AD. That stone fell down to the ground. It was the first thing as they knocked the stones down. And they did the archaeological research. And if you go to the next slide, there's the actual stone. And it had an inscription on it saying, this is the corner, this is where you blow the trumpet to announce Shabbat. They've chiseled off that original inscription and placed it into the museum, but the stone is there where our pilgrims are standing. Another incredibly important reason why this is such a holy spot. Go to the next slide. If you would continue around that corner, you come to the stairs that would have been climbed where people would have congregated to go into the temple area. This is the very location where we took our group shot, where on Pentecost Sunday when Peter preached his sermon, remember that, and 3,000 people were converted and baptized. There was a source of water nearby that he would have used. Same location. These were the steps when people arrived at Jerusalem to go to the temple, they would have climbed up. Remember the story in Luke 2 when Jesus, Mary, and Joseph go up to the temple and they start to leave and they realize, whoop, where's Jesus? And they have to go back and find Jesus in the temple. These are the stairs they would have climbed back up. Same location. John tells us in the gospel today, in John 2, that it was the feast of the Passover, and we know that at the feast of Passover, all adult males and probably always would take their families and they'd go up to Jerusalem. These are the stairs that they would climb. And when they would get there, they would want to go into the temple and offer a sacrifice. Doves, goats, sheep, cattle. It all depended on what you needed to sacrifice, what you were celebrating or giving God thanks for. But you had to buy that animal that you would sacrifice. Hence, there were money changers there. Why money changers? Because remember, at this time of Jesus' time, they were under Roman occupation. And all of the coins had whose inscription on it? Caesar. Because Caesar was God? Well, that's idolatry. You don't want to have other gods, as we heard in the commandments today. So they had to have different coins that they would use. Hence, the inception of what has come down to us today as the shekel. A coin that you would buy, you would change your money. And of course, these guys would make a little money in the transfer of the money exchange. Now, here's what happens. It's the Feast of Passover. In Jesus' day, it's estimated there were about 50,000 people who lived in Jerusalem. But at the Passover day, because all the adult males had to come and their families, it's estimated that it would be upwards of 200,000 people who would descend upon the temple. Now think of this as the Del Rey affair on a nice day. You can hardly move. And what's going to happen? Well, this is the chance for these vendors and money exchangers to make a killing. And so, if we go to the next slide, if you look to the left where that man is standing, that was the normal area where the money changers would have been. But because of those crowds, they're going to stay there. They're going to want to get to the people. This is my chance. And so the money changers and the people selling the doves and the cattle and the goats and the sheep and everything else, guess what? They're in the temple. Now think of this in terms of all the history that I just recapped for you. The site of Abraham's sacrifice. The site of the Ark of the Covenant. The site of the place where Jesus said no to the devil. The site where Jesus had walked up there to preach and to teach so many times and where his parents had gone. Does he have a right to be angry that they're doing this in the temple? You betcha. And so now we get an insight into why he'd go there and overturn the tables. Now the thing we need to get in our hearts here, though, is that this is only the second chapter of John. This is the beginning of John's gospel. All the other gospel writers have this same story, but it's towards the end. John puts it in the beginning. Now, we must want to make a point. And remember, John wrote his gospel to people like us, people who already believe. He's trying to write it to them to strengthen their faith. So perhaps what John is wanting us to do here is maybe get in touch with anger. Maybe get in touch with those 6 or 3 or 20 times a week and figure out what God might be calling us to do with that and every other raw emotion that we have. Think of John's gospel after that beautiful prologue about the Word became flesh. There's John the Baptist baptizing Jesus, and John has to have the tables in his mind overturned to understand that God's plan is different from what he had planned. Then Jesus goes, and he chooses those first disciples, middle-aged men who already had careers, and they had to have some things turned over in their mind that maybe Jesus wanted them to do something else. Then Jesus goes to Cana. And in Cana, he himself has to have things overturned in his mind a bit about what God's plan is for him as he does his first miracle. And then we come to this. So maybe there's some things inside of us that need to be overturned a bit. And I'd like us to look at our anger. The most important thing is, what do we do when we get angry? What I always tell people, they will come to me and they will say, I need to talk to you because I am so mad. And the first thing I will say is, well, first thing is, don't act right now. Just take a step back and sleep on it and pray on it. Because normally when we get angry, there is something behind that anger that we need to get in touch with. We can envision Jesus' mind thinking of all those things that I just mentioned and seeing the animals running through the temple, and it wasn't blessing of the animals Sunday, and he had to be really mad. And so for us, it becomes this opportunity to look, what is it that this is doing to me? And then secondly, how can I take that anger and channel it to make a difference that is good for other people? Therein lies the opportunity. If we could go to the next slide, please. I want to give you an example of a man who shows us how to do that. His name is Ramon McLoof. We met Ramon as we arrived at Ben-Gurion Airport in Tel Aviv, and he was with us throughout our trip. We all had tear-filled goodbyes with him at the airport when we left. He was with us throughout our time. He's our tour guide. He was our friend. He was chosen, if you read the blog, as the personality of the month in This Week in Palestine magazine. And I want to read to you the first paragraph that Ramon wrote in his article. He's a Palestinian Christian. He writes this. My home is Jerusalem. This is what I always answer when my tour groups ask me where I'm from. I was born on the Mount of Olives, and I have lived in Jerusalem all my life. I grew up in the Christian quarter of the old city. My father is buried on Mount Zion. My grandfather's tomb is in the Garden of Gethsemane. Ramon can trace his ancestry in Jerusalem back 400 years. But you know what? As a Palestinian Christian, he's not allowed to be a citizen of the country in which he lives. He pays taxes. He has a family apartment in Bethlehem that is now walled like a prison. And to go in and out, you have to go through a border guard as if you were going from West to East Germany. We experienced this. And every time we would have one of those experiences, I could hear in his voice the anger that was welling up within me each and every time. But you know what? Every time that happened, he would then turn the tables in his own mind and heart and talk about how we are called to be living stones and witnesses to the rest of the world. Ramon told us that one time, one of his pilgrims had a vision for him, and it's something that he took to heart, that instead of leaving and moving his family to a safer and more accepting environment, he was going to stay and be a living stone and a witness. 80% of the people who visit Israel are Christians. What he is doing with his life is taking that anger, that pre-moral feeling, and channeling it to make a difference for so many others. He did it for the 30 of us. He does it for countless pilgrims throughout the year. He does it for the people with whom he lives and works. So what are you angry about? And how might God be calling you to use that anger for the sake of the kingdom, not to destroy, but to build up? I want to end with a story that I think exemplifies and brings out the point of this little talk. It's about a temple in India where people would go up every week to worship, but there was a poisonous snake on the path to the temple who would always bite the people on their way to the temple. But one day, the Indian religious leader, the Swami, is walking up towards the temple, and just before the poisonous snake bites him, he puts the snake into a trance and says, "You will not bite me, and you will never bite anyone else again." And then he leaves. And he comes back a couple months later, and there he sees that poisonous snake on the side of the path to the temple, but it's all beat up and cut and bruised. And he says to the snake, "What's the matter with you?" And he says, "Well, you put me into that trance, and I am no longer able to defend myself." And the Swami said to the snake, "I told you you couldn't bite anyone, but I never told you you couldn't hiss at them." Perhaps the ability to hiss is the anger that God gives to us, because it can become the beginning of our call to action to make a positive difference in this world. May we be willing to do so. Amen.